Okay, so thanks. We'll make a start, as I just said. Hopefully one or two more will join us once we get going. So picking up again in Proverbs and spending probably half our time in Proverbs and then moving on to one of the other wisdom books, thought we would dot around a little bit and see if there's any Proverbs that immediately come to mind that you think that was an interesting one, or that's a strange one perhaps, or I wonder what that really means. And then I will say one or two things and point you in direction of one or two other proverbs, and we'll just keep going like that. Does anyone have anything to, just letting people in as they now coming in, of course, now we've started. Anyone got anything immediately to get us going?
I do have one, but I had one last time, so I'll let other people.
Come on, get us going. You can start.
So I just want to know what people think. It's 28:2, and I've come across it before, and I've discussed it in other, it's come up in other prayer meetings. When a country is rebellious, it has many rulers, but a ruler with discernment and knowledge maintains order. And to me, it kind of is that thing of a country gets the rulers it deserves, or the leaders it deserves. I don't know what other people make.
So you think it means when a country is rebellious against God in particular, it lacks stability within the ruling? In other words, you suddenly find you've got three prime ministers within 2 months or something. That sort of situation.
Wow!
Trying to make it relevant, I don't know. But anyway, it's almost like once a country goes down the wrong path, everybody becomes the ruler. Everybody can have their say and sort of say how it should be, because you haven't got the one person at the top who can say, this is right, this is right.
Yeah. And we have the same in England at the moment. With various people sort of putting out big pronouncements and writing little booklets. And...
Right. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
But it says a man of understanding and knowledge maintains order.
Yeah.
So... we haven't really got that at the moment, have we, it seems?
No. Not one outstanding person to obviously do the job. But I suppose part of the proverb is to say, and how common would that be anyway? I mean, Israel went through ups and downs with that, didn't they? Good kings, bad kings. Some that were following God's laws, others that were not. So it's probably... like a lot of proverbs, it's an observation based upon reality. And particularly in those days, what the king did, others followed as well. So it's very important to have a godly person in charge. John or Rose?
Yeah, but kind of reminds us of Judges, really, where everybody did what they thought was right in their own eyes. That effect.
Yeah. Malcolm?
I can't remember the reference, but the one proverb that sticks in my mind is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Yeah. Well, that probably occurs several times. It's certainly right towards the beginning. I'm going to guess it's chapter 1 and verse 9, and not quite, verse 7. And chapter 1 and verse 7, after the opening little sort of prologue to the whole thing, you've got this verse standing out, the fear of the Lord's beginning of wisdom, and it's gonna come through again several times in the opening chapters. Mary?
This is Proverbs 3. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean on your own understanding.
Yeah.
In all your faith, acknowledge him and he will direct your paths.
Yeah, that's a good favourite one, isn't it? That I would think we could say that's definitely true all the time, or as much as anyone. Who we got next? Elizabeth?
Just a follow on from the one that Alison had in 28. Proverbs 29:12 says, If a ruler listens to lies, all his officials become wicked.
Right. Yes, it spreads, in other words. Yeah, it does. Anyone else at this stage? Well, I'm going to focus on one in a minute, one that's very well known and perhaps not that well understood. But I just wanted to say something in general, and you can still come up with one. Okay, I'm sort of treading a bit of water while you might still be thinking. That's fine. But the book of Proverbs is almost central to the wisdom books of the Old Testament, because it believes very firmly that there is a fundamental order within the universe, that there are ruling principles from God, which is there in nature and in human activity. And the task of wisdom is to search these out, find them, and live by them, so that you end up living in harmony with God and his creation. So if you find the wisdom and live by it, then you strengthen this natural order, or like a spiritual order, the fundamental order in which God has created everything. But if you don't, then the opposite will happen and you contribute towards chaos and decline. So it's almost like wisdom has a task which involves a search. And out of that search comes something that we then consider and seek to apply in order to sort of join in with the wisdom of God. And the essence behind the idea of a proverb, there's two things really. One is it's just a powerful word, something that really hits home. It's a word for a situation that really makes sense. Or sometimes it's a comparison, what we call a similitude, or a like this. You know, A is like B. In order to understand more about A or B, we compare it with something. So it's a search for analogies and comparisons in order to let one thing highlight something else. And the test of a proverb, really, because anyone can sort of make something up, the real test of it is whether or not, when people hear it for the first time, does it somehow ring true? Do they sense that joins in, it fits in with the rest of the perceived wisdom? It's like having a big puzzle, and yes, oh, that's another piece that goes in there. There'll be something that will ring true, and yet also something that has to be thought a bit more deeply about. So it's not trivial. So it tries to do two things at once. It tries to sort of say, and think about this, it's obvious, it's true, and then think about it a bit more and see if you learn something extra from it. So there's an observation factor which says, we all know this, don't we? And then there's the sort of, now let's puzzle it through a little bit more and see what we can really get out of it. Now, if Proverbs represents the traditional wisdom side of things, based upon this is how life works, this is what God has set up, here's some little sayings to help you find that and live by it. When you come to the other books like Ecclesiastes and Job, as I think I mentioned at the beginning of all this, why are they in the Bible and not other books like, we talked about Ecclesiasticus and Ben Sirach, why aren't they in? Because they seem to be more like Proverbs. And it's as though we need something to contrast with what's often thought of as a very neat, orderly, tidy setup, which says, oh, well, life's like this, and if A, then B, and everything's going to be fine. But in reality, we know life isn't always like that. So you need something to counter it. And the essence of the book of Job and of the book of Ecclesiastes, in their own particular way, is to put a bit of a spanner in the works of traditional wisdom and say, actually, we need to think even more widely about various things, such as suffering, life, death, meaning, and so on. So it's there because the Bible likes to hold things in tension and likes to get us thinking even more widely. It's almost like, yeah, Proverbs are fine, they're jolly good, they're great most of the time, but sometimes life goes wrong and you can't find a proverb to apply, so you need to think more deeply. And Ecclesiastes and Job takes us along that path for us again to think a bit more out of it. So that's some general background and why I find the whole wisdom literature in the Bible, certainly in the Old Testament, quite fascinating, because it's almost like grating against itself in order, it's like iron sharpening iron, to try and develop wisdom even more. So with that in mind, has anybody happened to just come across another one or thought of one? Here we go, Elizabeth again.
Yeah, this is one I had outlined, underlined in my Bible, Proverbs 4:23. Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. And I think that's, I've been thinking a lot about the heart recently, and I really think that's something I want to meditate on more.
Yeah, it's interesting. Of all the, I think there's quite a few verses in chapter 4. So I remember that one about guard your heart. Which verse was that again? Verse?
23.
Yeah, because although it says above all else, guard your heart, which I think is very good, it goes on also to keep your mouth free, let your eyes look straight ahead, give careful thought to the path of your feet, etc. So everything you do flows from guarding your heart, but at the same time, this is a matter of guarding our eyes, our feet, and everything else that can lead us astray. So it's part of an interesting little section there. Thank you. Caroline?
Yes, 29:18, which I think is often misquoted, but it's, where there is no revelation, the people perish.
Yeah, which verse again? I've got the chapter now.
29:18.
18.
People often say where there is no vision and interpret that as like sort of their own ideas, but it actually is revelation.
Yeah, yeah, see what I mean. Yeah,
where
yeah.
No revelation, the people perish.
So if you don't have a vision for life, then it's all wasted and so on. But again, you think it means that if there's no revelation from God, or if God's wisdom is not being revealed, then people do what they like and now that's
actually says unrestrained.
Yeah.
In my version.
Yeah, that's right. It seems to me you mentioned there the idea that people either mistranslated or misunderstand it. I'm going to look at one in a minute, but that happens. We had a hand up, it's gone. Is it John Rose?
Yeah, it was just the New King James has a slightly different rendering. Where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint.
Yeah. That sounds more like a deliberate act, you mean, that they actually decide that's what they're going to do. Yeah.
And then it says, but blessed is he who keeps the law.
Yeah.
But there's the contrast there.
It is. And it's always good to read the second line of any of it. It might be reinforcing it. It might be giving the opposite by contrast. So, okay, well, my turn then. Let me point you to one that you really do know, but I wonder what we're going to make of it. So it's in chapter 22 and verse 6. Chapter 22 and verse 6. You've probably heard this quoted so many times. You've probably heard it quoted at the dedication of children or similar sort of things. And just want to start off by finding out if we've got different translations to help on this. I mean, I will read off, I'll read out the NIV that I have in front of me, which says, start children off on the way they should go, and even when they are old, they will not turn from it. That's one version of it. Anyone have anything where you might think, well, that's saying it a bit differently, or well, if that's adding anything to it?
Sorry, can you just confirm which proverb, is it
22:6?
Because in my NIV, which is the original NIV, it says, train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it.
Yeah, so the original NIV, as you call it, back to 1984 or something, I think, you've got train instead of start.
Mm.
Okay, I'll come back to that point. That is one of the key words that has been translated in different ways, and that needs digging into a little bit more. Otherwise, it's not that different, is it? But it's interesting. I've just started to look at the one that's called Today's New International Version, which is the 2004 version of it, where you can tell that they've just tweaked certain little bits. So it's not quite like a totally new translation, but they've changed one or two bits. Anyone have anything else from interesting translations that might start us on a different way of thinking on that particular verse?
I've got a cross reference, but it's nothing to do with a translation. It's or something that another verse from somewhere else that is kind of linked with the idea I have about that verse. Yeah. But we can come to that in a minute.
Well, okay, it might be, but yeah, okay. John,
the Amplified, train up a child in the way he should go, and then the bracket bit. And in keeping with his individual gift or bent, and when he is old, he will not depart from it.
Right. So it's essentially the same, but they've given you a bit more detail on what they think the first bit is about.
Indeed. Yeah.
Okay. I'll come back to that. That is one of the points to make from it.
Yes, mine's got a note, according to his way.
Okay. Very interesting. Yeah. Who else have we got? Malcolm, perhaps, next.
Yeah, I was going to say was that this CJB says he will not swerve from it.
Okay. Swerve, turn. I think that swerve is quite it's quite a good translation and so on. Pat? Pat, have you got something? You're muted still. Is that the one new man?
Yes, it is. 22:6 train up a youth in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. But there is a little footnote and says, a youth is late teens through 20s. So to have this relationship with a son or daughter at that age, parents must have done well in bringing up the child.
Right, okay. Okay. I think one of the things I've done is I've actually looked up the Hebrew to see if that helps me. There's one or two bits that do. The question is, if you like, how old is this child meant to be? And it seems to be not specifically age related. You've got a youth there as well. Okay. Well, let's look at the actual wording. But first of all, the essence of what nearly always is taught from this is that if the parent does this, then this will be the consequence, which is fine. That's the sort of statement it seems to be making. And it seems to be one where almost suppose a parent does start a child off in the right way, but they don't turn out in the end to be okay. In other words, they have turned away from it. Then you think, oh, that's not what should happen. So you either feel guilty or you blame God perhaps for giving them a promise that that doesn't fulfill. So the first thing we have to get our heads around is that proverbs are not promises. They're not guarantees of anything. Again, could this just be a general observation that if you do the right thing, then you can expect the right thing as a consequence, X percent of the time, where X is meant to be fairly large, but not necessarily 100. However, when you start to dig into the words a little bit more, there is another totally different emphasis that this verse is really giving. So let's look at the first word. And I did actually mention this because at the time I was sort of getting into this sort of thing, that the opening word, which is Hanok, is a hut word, which is similar to Hanukkah, and therefore in some translations it is dedicate. So you might have got translations, I thought some of you might come up with this, which is dedicate a child on the way. And is that where we get the idea of dedicating children when they're a few weeks old and so on? So that's going to make a huge difference. But the interesting thing about even the word dedicate, whichever sort of version of chanuk it is, when you actually look at all the different places where dedicate comes, if I asked you to think where the word dedicate comes, you'd all go for the temple, dedication of the temple. And so you'd think of a big ceremony and handing something over to God and all the rest of it. Proverbs 22 is the is only one of only five times where this word is used. Now, let's see where it's used elsewhere. In Deuteronomy chapter 20, this is a bit of an aside, but it's an interesting word study. And then we come back to our main verse. So let's have I got this right. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 5. This is one of these exemptions for going to war. I don't know if you are familiar with those. There's I think, three different excuses you could have for not actually going to war. And they're there in Deuteronomy 20. One of them seems to be to do with a house. One is to do with a vineyard. And one is to do with being engaged rather than married, pledged to a woman and not yet married. So if someone's built a new house but not yet begun to live in it, you can go home, just in case you die in battle and don't get a chance to finish it. If you planted a vineyard but not yet got any fruit from it, you can go back home and look after that rather than go to war, because you might die and then someone else takes it. And if you've got engaged to be married, well, we don't want you to die in battle and disappoint her. So, you know, go back and deal with that. So the point I'm getting at there is this idea of the chanuk, the dedication. It's purely about starting something off. It's nothing to do as such with training or dedicating anything. It's simply a word which says to inaugurate or to get something going. So you might have planted something, you might be building something, but it isn't yet completed because you haven't yet completely got to the end of what you set out to do, in other words. So it's not necessarily about a formal dedication, even a ceremony or anything. Even in terms of the temple, when Solomon dedicated the temple, although you might say it was like handing it over to God, and God did obviously come and at that time and so on, but it was almost like, now let's get it going properly. Let's have all these sacrifices. Let's put the right things in place and so on. So start, as in the Proverbs verse, is probably a good enough way of putting it. Initiate, if you like. It doesn't have to be dedicate or train. It's just get them going. Okay. And then the word child, it doesn't suggest how old that child is. In fact, in first I've read, it's actually plural, it's children. Don't necessarily know why it's come out as plural there. And then I've got here off on the way. So you might have got according to. Anyone got any other little phrase that goes after the start a child off or train a child? On the way or according to? Because that's a very interesting Hebrew idiom, which we wouldn't translate accurately. It's literally upon the mouth of, you know, so start a child off upon the mouth of the way, which makes no real sense to us. And so it's an idiom which stands for something else, which is according to the standard of, or the command of, after the measure of, and so on. Okay, so someone's put a quote there, it says according to. So we've got to translate an idiom there, and according to would be fine as a way to get around that. Now, the big question, though, after all that, is, okay, start a child off on the way, and then you get a phrase which doesn't really come into the Hebrew at all. If you've got something like the way they should go, that is an interpretation. So how have you come to understand this way they should go? How has it been explained to you, or how do you think your translation is trying to tell you what it means? By the way, just to go back to the idea of the na'ar, the child or the youth, it's used 250 times in the Old Testament from anyone from an infant to 30 years old. So it really isn't time specific. But coming back to the next bit, the way he should go. What do you make of that? We've got Malcolm.
No, Ronald was going to say about the age. I would have thought that it would have been up to bar mitzvah age.
Okay, but they didn't do bar mitzvah in the Old Testament at that time. But they did have a sort of age where you might think that they've moved away from being trained or started by their parents and become more adult in that. Yeah, okay. Alison and then Caroline, I think, in that order.
yeah, so I think that, as you said earlier, somebody, was it you or somebody else said earlier, it's like each person has a particular way they should be going. I mean, there's two things. One is that there are some things which are irrefutable. So there are certain ordinances of God that every child should follow. But maybe the way that they follow them, or the particular things that they follow up in what they do in their lives, might be particular to them. So that was where I was just going to go back to Psalm 16, verse 11. It says, "You make known to me the path of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence." I think in the King James, it talks about in your presence there is fullness of joy.
Right.
And I've just reread one of the children's books by Patricia St. John, The Rainbow Garden, and it very much picks up on this verse and how the various people within it and what the main player in the book had to follow the things that she needed to do to be following.
Right. And the first point you made referred back to the person that read from the Amplified, where in the brackety bit, if you like, there was this sort of alternative. And I'll mention that again in a moment. Okay. Caroline, have you got anything to add here?
Well, I was just going to say that surely the way you should go is God's way, or, you know, the straight and narrow.
As you just rightly said, surely, but I'm going to come up with a but in a minute. John?
Just looking at the interlinear, which I need a magnifying glass for, because it's right small. Train up a boy on the opening of his way.
Okay. Now, the opening bit is because of that idiom, upon the mouth of, which is an opening like you could use of a cave. So they've gone back to the idiom and given you the words from that. Anything else?
Well, underneath the Hebrew, it talks about the mouth of, and then the trans is kind of translation, as it were.
Right.
So he's got both in there.
Yeah. Okay. Have you got anything in that, Bob, on that translation, on the word for way, darko, from Derek?
Not really.
Okay. I
mean, it's got the Strong's number, but we don't have that at the hand, so sorry.
I don't know if you know, but the Hebrew for way or path is, we have the name Derek, Derek, and this is derived from that, Darko, Derekko, which is a third person masculine with a suffix of O or something, and it occurs 8 times in Proverbs. Now, the point is that the idea that it is God's way is not in the text at all. There's no reference to God. It's not even about he should go. It's not a matter of the right path, the path of right living, righteousness, or whatever. So any translation that puts the way they should go is really already starting to point you in a certain direction. Like you said, surely, because other proverbs seem to suggest this anyway, surely this means that he should go in God's way. But that's not really in the text and not really what it's getting at. Now, that's why you get this alternative, which once I realized that actually doesn't say God's way, because that's where the disappointment comes in. I brought him up in the Christian faith. We went to church all the time and so on, and he left home and suddenly look where he is now. This doesn't work, sort of thing. Well, it doesn't work because it's not a promise and it's not about that anyway. So the alternative, which is again is a strong candidate for it, is a parent's duty to find out what each individual child really should be doing in life. What is the path that they should be on? What characteristics and abilities and so on has God given them? And so the best way to bring a child up is, if you like, a child-centered way, not a, well, he's my son, I want him to do this. You know, I'm good at this, he's got to follow in my footsteps. I want him to be like me, a chip off the old block. But good parenting is actually looking carefully at the person in front of you and saying, I wonder what God has given him to do, and making sure that he has those opportunities. Now, I think there's some truth in that, although I still don't think it's what the verse is saying. But I think, you know, anybody that's brought up children would say, isn't that the thing you meant to do? You know, don't make him learn to play the piano if he's better at playing golf or something. You know, make sure you find out what his talents are and encourage him in that sort of way. But the point about this word for way, every other time it's used, it's used to mean or suggest the way that person has decided they want to go. It's not the way they should go because it's God's way, or even anything that God puts in them. It's their own willfulness. It's their own choice. In other words, it's letting the child have his own way. Now, when you realize that that's what the first bit of the verse is about, the second bit then makes perfect sense, and even more so, because it's basically saying, if you let a child from early on do what he wants, let him go his own way, okay, then he will never get out of that. He will always end up doing his own thing. It becomes an ingrained habit. So in other words, if you allow him to go his own ways, the way, not he should go, but the way he chooses to go, and then the rest of it is, even if he gets old, it's almost, that even is a good word to put in there. It's not just sort of and. Even if he gets old, however old he gets, however long he lives, he's still going to go on doing his own thing, going his own way, thinking he knows best. And therefore the verse is effectively a warning. It's primarily a warning to the parents. If you let a child go his own way early on, don't expect him to change later. And that is a bigger promise, almost more guaranteed than anything else. Because if you let a child decide himself what he wants to do, what's right and wrong, I want, I'm going to do this, and so on, and you never correct him or you never say, you know, direct him in any particular way, then what chance has he got later on? Now, that makes better sense of the words used, and it gets out of some of the awkwardness of trying to pretend that this is something to do with God's way or any particular characteristics of the child. And I want to comment upon that. I might just have one or two more little bits to that, but do you think you could now read that proverb in that way? It's not a command to actually do something. It's a warning that if you do something, then this is what you can expect. It's a consequential proverb in that sense, if you like. If you allow him his way, he'll find it very difficult to deviate from it in later life. That makes sense of all the bits and pieces of it. John?
Time to educate the translators, I guess.
Well, yes, okay. It's important. I mean, some books have got that. I mean, this isn't me deciding that I know better on all this. It's just not the standard way of doing it. It's almost like the standard way is, well, it's sort of right as well, and you probably find it in other proverbs, but is it really what's going on in this particular one? A bit more thought was needed on, if you like, not trying to make it fit something that you think is already the case. Just to give you a bit more flavour of, if like, in the way this sort of statement works, it's not telling the parent what to do. They say it's warning them what will happen if they do. And there are other examples in scriptures where that sort of thing is said. It's basically, you do that and see what happens, sort of thing. I'll give you one which I from the New Testament, which I think you'll appreciate. John chapter 2 and verse 19. John 2, 19. I'll see if I can find one or two more in the Old Testament, but John 2, 19 is one that you will know and you will understand it in the right way. If you've got it, you'd like to read it out, because I'm not looking for that one, I'm looking for something else. What does Jesus say in John 2:19?
Is it the one that it says, Jesus answered them, destroy this temple?
Yeah.
Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's it. Go on.
And I will raise it again in 3 days. Sorry, I have someone at the door.
Okay. Destroy this temple. Has anyone got a different version they want to add to that, or are you all happy with that? In other words, the point is Jesus actually telling them to destroy him? He's not giving them a command to do something, but he's almost saying, if you do this, then this is what will happen. Okay? It's that sort of idea. It's called an ironic imperative, which means it sounds like a command, but it's ironic in order to make a point. It's not intended to produce the commanded action. In fact, it's intended to produce the opposite. It's intended not to be carried out. Don't do this unless you want this. Now, of course, in Jesus' case, he's saying, destroy this temple and this is what will happen, knowing that it was going to happen, so on. But it's using irony in a command in order to, well, issue a warning about, you want to go this way? Well, fine. That's what you can expect. Now, you might object on the basis that it's still not a guarantee, because you can let a child go his own way and he could still eventually turn to God. But don't forget, particularly in the Old Testament, they didn't quite have this same strong idea of conversion that we do in the New Testament in sort of gospel times, where we know full well that people have been rescued from lives of ruin at whatever age, you know, 60, 70, 80 or whatever, even though they were allowed to go their own way for decades. But in the Old Testament, it very much was a case of parental upbringing and so on, rather than sort of later conversion. So it's a warning for parents, very strong warning in the case that here, what hope has he got, this child, in later life, if he's allowed to do his own thing now? So, of course, God can still intervene and so on, but there we are. Right. Okay. Let's keep going. I'm wanting to move away from Proverbs in one point. I think John again.
yeah, sorry to bring you back. The word dedicate that you had earlier.
Yeah.
It's I don't know if it's the same word, actually, Hebrew word used, but often it's actually dedicated to God and burnt up by fire, which is kind of
wrong. Yeah, okay.
That's one way to get your kid to do what you tell them.
From what I said, that word that's used there, and it's based upon the root that we know of as Hanukkah, wouldn't be that kind of thing. I think that's devoted. I think that's what we're getting, isn't it? Isn't there a word where devoted to God, and that means dedicated in terms of sacrifice?
Right. Yeah.
This just simply means to start, to initiate. For us, dedicate isn't quite the right word. And I don't think many translations now have dedicate. In the old ones, it might have done. So I'm not making an issue with the start or get going or initiate children and so on. It's more on this way they should go, which is better thought of as letting them do their own thing, letting them go their own way early on.
Thank you.
Because once they learn that as a way of living, then it's very difficult to get out of that. You know, selfishness gets ingrained. I thought we ought to look, before we do leave Proverbs, to look at the two, what we might call guest appearances at the end. Most of the Proverbs are by Solomon, but towards the end, there's a couple of other people that come into play. So chapter 30 and 31. Chapter 31 is usually very well known. But in chapter 30, we will start there with the particular guest author coming forward. We have to ask the question, who is this guy? And how has he got himself in this book? Why is he thought of as being particularly worthy of a point? Anyone got anything to share with us about who Agur actually is? Any notes or footnotes or anything to help us at all? Because the only thing I've got here is that he's the son of someone else, so I don't know about either. Do you think he is an Israelite? From what he actually says, I mean, that's the important thing. Let's read this. It's really the first four verses. He seems to have got an inspired utterance. Well, when you read that, those four verses, does that tell you anything about him, for instance? You think, oh yeah, we needed to hear that. That was really inspired.
In my notes in the NIV study Bible, it says he would have been associated with an Ishmaelite people.
Right. So not Israelite, non-Israelite, not from the tradition. Okay. Now, not all the earlier Proverbs are Israelite-based. Some of them are Egyptian-based because either that's where Solomon collected them from or there was a joint sort of wisdom. I don't have conventions of proverb makers that got together, you know, international conferences on it or something. But Proverbs did move across different sort of countries and that. But it looks like this is someone who doesn't belong to the Hebrew tradition, shall we say. Pat, what do you got for us?
It just gives you in 30 verse 1, in the footnote, it says the chapter is a later addition to the book, although tradition says Agur is another name for Solomon.
Right, okay. Well, that would be helpful if it was. Yeah. I mean, we can certainly say that these last two chapters are sort of appendices, and who knows how they got sort of compiled eventually and put on there. Any other thoughts on him from either your study Bibles or anything you know? Do you think he's actually, never mind then who he is, do you think he's actually saying anything that we really need to hear? I am weary, God, but I can prevail. Surely I am only a brute, not a man. I do not have human understanding. I've not learned wisdom, nor have I attained to the knowledge of the Holy One. And then he asks lots and lots of questions and ends up, what is his name? What's the name of his son? Surely you know. Now, is that the sort of wisdom we expect to hear in the book of Proverbs? Or does it seem to be something that's already throwing a bit of a spanner in the works? Monica.
Oh, yeah. Can you hear me okay? Because my laptop's a bit funny.
Yeah, I'm hearing you.
Okay. I've got a footnote here that says he's met Massa is mentioned in Genesis 25:14 as the son of Ishmael.
Yeah, I think that's where we just had that even been Ishmael. And where did you get Massa from? Is that an alternative to an inspired utterance?
Massa, the words of Agur, the son of Jake, the Massan.
Yeah.
So they, they're saying that he's a descendant of the Massa mentioned in Genesis.
Yeah. So in other words, rather than an inspired utterance, it's one of those things where does the word actually mean words like that, or does it mean a name or place or something? That is an alternative. So I've got here as well, one option is he was a famous sage of Massa, one of the peoples of the East with whom Solomon was compared. So yes, it might go back to Genesis, but it actually gets a mention in 1 Kings in relation to Solomon himself. And just on this issue, jumping ahead to chapter 31, where again, you've got the sayings of another guy now, King Lemuel, an inspired utterance. And again, you might have got a footnote that says the meaning of this phrase is rather uncertain. At least I think that's the where the footnote's referring to. I can't actually see it now. But anyway, you've got the same words, an inspired utterance, which instead may also mean he was from the kingdom of Massa. Now, in which case then, if that's how you're meant to understand that, his utterance may not be that inspired after all. It may be something that's put there in order to make us think differently, maybe even to refute in that. So in other words, if you then read the rest of the chapter from verse 5 onwards, you could say, ah, now this is the response to this sort of thing, his idea of being weary and all the rest of it, and I don't know anything, because almost he's denying the fact that you can get wisdom. You know, I'm only a brute, not a man. I don't even have human understanding. I've not learned it. I can't attain the knowledge of the Holy One. Who can do that, if you like? Yes, the rest of Proverbs has been back. Well, seek wisdom, and you'll find it. Get fear of the Lord, and you'll start to find wisdom and all the rest of it. And it's almost like this guy is given up or saying it's impossible. What a waste of time all that is, sort of thing. So maybe the rest of the chapter is someone, whoever it is, whether it's Solomon himself or another Israelite sage or something, actually saying, it's not true. Every word of God is flawless, etc., etc., and eventually comes up with a better approach to what he's saying. Now, all I'm saying is this is a bit of a puzzle, this chapter. You've got someone here who doesn't seem to be towing the line, perhaps. And we've got to sort of make something of it, sometimes in the basis of, is he meant to be refuted in some way? There's almost a sort of Job-like thing here, isn't it, about who has gone up to heaven and come down? Is that reminding you of sort of the sort of questions that occur, as I said, in the other wisdom books, which are different from Proverbs? Is this a bit of a challenge, therefore?
Yeah, very much like the end of Job,
yeah.
Or even some of the words that God speaks, as it were, in Job.
Yeah,
it's and it made me wonder at one point whether whether Solomon had a hand in the crafting of some of the words of Job.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. But in all these things, the sheer words on the page don't always enable you to understand, are these rhetorical questions? What's his tone of voice in all this? Is he sort of trying to quote something and misquoting it, or just getting things a bit wrong, like happened in Job, for instance? And therefore, is the response that of a truer believer, so to speak? But I think it just shows that when you come to that chapter, you've got to read it a bit differently from all the other ones that you've just been reading time and again, these two-liners that's clearly all saying the same sort of thing, all, shall we say, singing from the same hymn sheet, and then suddenly you get something a bit different. And the last chapter, again, someone else turning up to add something to it, and something I didn't realise, I looked at it carefully, it's talked about the saying of King Lemuel, but in fact, you could argue that certainly the first bit is really what his mother taught him. These are the wise sayings, or if that's what you translate it as, of his mother. In the first part of Proverbs, it's always been about father instructing a son. Son, listen to my words, your father. This is now a mother saying, listen to my son. Listen, son of my womb, just in case we haven't worked out that it really is his mother, and so on. So it's almost like he is a wise mother realizing that her son is about to become a king, and he better therefore wise up, and in particular, not do certain things like spend your strength on women, don't drink too much wine, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So up to the verse 9, you know, you've got the advice of a mother quite concerned, perhaps, that once her son becomes king, things might go awfully wrong. And then from chapter 10, sorry, verse 10 onwards, you get this very well-known poem, basically, of a wife of noble character, as it's usually called. So the chapter definitely splits into two. Who exactly is saying verse 10 onwards, whether it's the king himself now, or whether it's his mother actually now giving him some more advice on make sure you marry the right person sort of thing. But this this epilogue, this final bit, how many verses is the final bit? Can you work it out quickly enough?
30?
'cause from verse 10 onwards. Okay.
21.
Think again.
22.
Yeah, it's always the thing. You go from 10 to 31 and think that's 21. It's 22. Why do you think it's 22 verses?
It's acrostic.
Okay, if you've seen your footnotes on that. It's what's called an alphabetical poem, an acrostic. So why 22 then? Because?
It's an Ivrit.
So I missed it. Sorry, say it again.
It's an Ivrit in Hebrew.
Yeah.
So it's 22 letters. In
22 letters, that's right. So each verse, it's saying, if you like, begins with each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's like some of the Psalms have been. So this is clearly very neatly compiled or composed. So it's a delightful poem in its own way, but someone has given it a lot of thought in order to get it to fit this particular scheme. So anyone, any comments upon those verses at the very end of the book? Anyone got anything that they either find now or remember from the past on that chapter? It might be Mary. Monica, your hand is still up, but that might be from before. Mary, I think next.
These are not the verses that are recited at the Shabbat or
where the husband is honoring the wife. Yeah, not surprised. It's really good. John, or maybe it's Rose wanting to come in on the words about the wonderful woman. or is John going to quote it for Rose's sake? I don't know.
No, John doesn't quote that one.
Okay.
I'm going to say, I know when I was much younger, many people felt that women shouldn't work. They should stay home and be housekeepers.
Right.
Because it wasn't right for women to go out and get a job. Yet this, there's clearly no biblical support for that, because this lady is working from sun up to sundown while the husband's sitting on his bum out at the gate.
I say.
No, he's an important man. He might have
still sitting on his bum with his bright thoughts.
Okay. Well, I'm sure he's doing something equally wonderful, but it's great. I mean, she's got strong arms for the tasks and all that sort of thing. And she's up all hours and don't matter what the weather is and all the rest of it. She just keeps going. And her children praise her as well as her husband. So she's wonderful.
And she's clearly in business because she considers fields, buys them, sells them. So she's...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if she ever sleeps, but I mean, I'm just worn out reading it. I mean, to be honest, I don't know how you can keep up with this. It does sound almost a bit too good to be true. But I think the verse 30 is sort of sums up, a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. It's back to the idea that clearly all this is because she fears the Lord, and she is totally godly in all this. She does not eat the bread of idleness, one of those lovely phrases. I've never bought any bread of idleness. I suppose it just means that it's ordinary bread, but it's the way you eat it. I don't know. But
probably full of holes.
Sorry, John?
The bread of idleness is probably full of holes.
Yes.
I think she's the original multitasker, isn't she?
Indeed, yes. Yeah.
Way decades ago, when Hillary Clinton was first being considered to run for, I don't know what, first, she wasn't much of a first lady because she wasn't domestic and she worked too much.
Right.
So much criticism that she wasn't a homemaker. She publicized her chocolate chip cookie recipe. But there was just a lot of opposition to her because she wasn't a stay-at-home working housewife. When there's right. clearly no biblical justification for staying home and doing nothing. Or not earning money.
Well, her husband wasn't much better, was he?
He should have been baking the cookies.
So it's worth thinking, you know, the structure of the book, it ends with these two extra chapters in some way. Just a couple more points, perhaps. If we go back to chapter 2, not making a big deal about this, look at the first six verses of chapter 2. I'm interested in here in how the structure of it works. It's a sort of example. So it's not so much what it's saying, it's how it's saying it. Because there's a difference between the way the different verses work. At least I thought there was. I'm just a bit wondering whether I'm sure I've got the right bit. Look at the first six verses of chapter 2. And the reason I'm saying they're a sort of block is that to start with, can you see all the ifs? There's an if at the very beginning. Yes, my son, if you accept my words. How many, should we call them, ifs statements, conditional statements, can you see in those verses? You found any more than the very first one?
Was at least three.
Okay. And where are the other two then? Which verses? Just so we've all got them.
Three and four.
Okay. So the first block, verse two is almost following on from verse one. So it's if, and if. And then it changes in five because you've got the follow-up, the consequence of it, the then. So if this, then you will do this, and verses five and six sort of follow from that. Now, your translations may almost sort of undermine what I'm about to say, but the structure of the first verse is basically, if you receive my sayings and my commandments, you treasure up with you. Now, my translation has got, if you accept my words and store up my commands, but in Hebrew, it's actually reversed. So listen again, if you receive my sayings and my commandments, you treasure. So that's got a, what we call this sort of reverse form, like A, B, and then B, A. The second part, the translation might have switched it back round again, but it's going A, B, B, A, reflective, if you like. And the next bit, turning your ear to wisdom and applying your heart to understanding is actually going in strict parallel. That really is like A, B, A, B. So turning your ear to wisdom, your heart to understanding. So sometimes it works in that form, the straightforward A, B, A, B. Other times it's switched round. And in verse 3, you've got it in the normal form, if you like. You call out for insight, cry aloud for understanding. Now, verse 4, again, it looks like that, but in Hebrew it's been turned round. Is if you look for it as silver and as hidden treasures, you search for it. So your English is trying to force everything into the same mold. But in fact, in Hebrew thinking, they love to have this, you know, the first will be last, the last will be first, the A, B, B, A, the switching round. So those four verses with all the conditions are actually going in one direction, then one kind, and then the next kind, and then back to the first kind. So there's a pattern in the four verses so that you get reflection, parallel, parallel, reflection, put it like that. Now, if you're reading in Hebrew, you'd spot that, and it all adds to the apparently the enjoyment of reading Hebrew poetry. And in fact, verse 5 is a backwards one, if you like. Again, the translation may not have this, but you will understand the fear of the Lord and the knowledge of God you will find. That's how it's actually written in the Hebrew. I don't suppose anyone has got a translation that actually does it that way. I suppose you've all got very English. Now, hello, John, are you showing your magnifying glass for a reason?
Yeah, it's the interlinear. So therefore, under the Hebrew, it has it that way. But when it puts it across, it's the other way around.
Yeah, I think it's rather a nice way of being very poetical, but, you know, English doesn't quite understand how Hebrew poetry works sometimes. I mean, try and stick to what we know rather than that. Malcolm?
Yeah, verse 5 in the Secret B says, then you will understand the fear of Adonai and find knowledge of God. But what I put my hand up for originally was in verse 1, the second part says, and store my commands inside you. Which is different.
It means that, like in all these things, it's got to not just go in one ear and out the other, but it's got to be something that you really, to gain wisdom, you've got to have it deep within you. One more thing that's worth just mentioning. I wonder how we read all these nice proverbs and we think, oh, that's neat and we like that. I wonder how much effort it takes to write a proverb to actually get something that says a lot in a very little, that immediately is recognised as being valuable and worthwhile, not just something to sort of laugh at or whatever, and almost expands back into its meaning once you think about it. Now, that to me is a skill. It's not going to be something that anybody can just suddenly sit down and do. I think it must be something that it's part of being a sage, like a wise person. It's like that they must see a bigger picture, distill it down to its essence, create this, sometimes this just comparison, oh, this is like that, leave it like that, so that when you read it, it hopefully expands back again in your own mind, so that the reader has as much enjoyment out of expanding it back again than the writer probably had in trying to distill it to its essence. So you might read it very quickly, very easily, and think, oh, that sounds interesting, and probably just dashed off in a second or two. But probably there's a lot more skill involved in writing a proverb. I don't know whether you've ever tried to write any proverbs yourself. I don't know whether that's something that gets set at school or something, you know. Try and write a proverb. And I bet it's very difficult. If you try and come up with something, everyone will go, what's that about? What does that mean? Let's appreciate those that have gone to all this trouble of writing all these different sayings for us. John?
Yeah, as you point out, it's distilled into really concentrated kind of information. And actually the whole of the Bible is really like that, in that there's, you know, I mean, you just read through it. It reads, you know, mostly very easily and well. And you just skip along, but actually, if you were to pause, there's a huge amount of it needs ruminating on and reflecting on.
Yeah, it's back to this idea of meditating, isn't it? You know, chewing it over in such a way. Yeah.
During the curtains.
Elizabeth.
Well, I was just thinking. I mean, every word comes from God, doesn't it? But obviously, God. Solomon asked for wisdom and God gave him wisdom, and this is really the outcome of of that.
Yeah.
For our benefit.
I think that sums up what I'm about to say, is that you might think a proverb's there just to teach us wisdom. Actually, they come from the wisdom of the person themselves, but also you need wisdom to dig into it and chew it over and so on. It's part of a process by which the wise person communicates to a wise person who then becomes wiser as a result. I've not said that very well, but it's something that it requires some wisdom to get you going, but it helps to develop the wisdom you already have if you've got a wise teacher that's telling you this sort of thing. But it's not a magical formula. And I think there's a proverb, chapter 26 and verse 9. I'll check it out before telling you for sure. Yeah, chapter 26 and verse 9. Like a thorn bush in a drunkard's hand is a proverb in the mouth of a fool. Okay, you can spend the rest of your week pursuing that one if you like. So it's like, I mean, a thorn bush in a drunkard's hand. I mean, had someone actually observed a drunkard going around and grabbing hold of a thorn bush and so on, and that sparked this off, and he said, oh, that's just like a proverb in the mouth of a fool. Proverbs don't work if you're a fool. You need at least to have some wisdom. You don't get wise just by simply repeating wise words, I suppose is one way of putting it. But a proverb is very compressed. It's crafted to be memorable, certainly. Maybe practical, but certainly thought-provoking. It's someone has described a proverb as truth dressed to travel. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I think it's about it encapsulates something and you send it on its journey in the hope that it ends up with someone else who can undo it a bit and make it make something of it, if you like. So in some ways, a proverb is simpler, is similar to bigger things like parables or allegories, but they're easier because you've got more time and words and space to do stuff with. So it's almost like you write your parable or your allegory or something, and then you've got to try and compress it down to just sometimes 8 to 10 words, certainly two lines at most. I mean, in Hebrew, there's far fewer words than in our English translations. So is it bite-sized wisdom? Well, they come in bite sizes, but they have to be chewed over. The brevity of it is important, but without unpacking it, you're not going to get what it's really about. And one thing I haven't mentioned is the actual word wisdom. In Hebrew, generally is the word wisdom, which is chokmah, I think I remember that correctly. It's a very interesting word. If you want to follow that up as a word study sometime. It's used all over the scriptures to mean all kinds of skills and understanding and so on. For instance, you know, those that built the tabernacle were specially skilled in a certain way. People who sail boats and so on, they had certain wisdom in order to be able to get where they wanted to go and so on. So it's a very widely used word, this chokmah, this wisdom. It was even used of animals. I think that's in Proverbs as well. That's right, have a little look. Oh, I see. Okay, this is back in chapter 30. The bit about ants of little creature, little strength, and yet they store up their food and all the rest of it. So sometimes even the animals seem to act wisely and so on. So it's mainly wisdom, but it's also skill, ability, using your wits, having certain sort of even artistic sort of things. Well, that's Proverbs, which is the main book on this. We're going to move on next time to another book, but we'll spend a few minutes now on this, because some of you have already been reading it, apparently, and that's Ecclesiastes. And someone was saying before we really got going that they read it in the Amplified version, is that right? So Alison and then Rose, can you start us off on this? Tell us what you've been doing. and how that worked. What's happened there?
This is Ecclesia.
Yeah, I read it a while ago. I used to think it was a really depressing book, and what on earth did it mean, and why should the Bible have a book that said that everything was meaningless? And then I got a copy of the Amplified Bible and decided to read it cover to cover, the book of Ecclesiastes, because it's short enough to read in one sitting, just about. And it just made a lot more sense that,
just because the words were amplified and you had several options for meaning.
I think so, that you can mull over the fact that if you're not really concentrating, then life can meander through in a very meaningless way. But things are hidden from us, and you have to kind of search them out, whether they're good or evil, as it finishes.
Yeah.
That God will bring every deed into judgment, and whether things are good or bad, God will judge it all. So actually life's not meaningless at all. There is something in everything.
So you would recommend reading it in?
I'd recommend just reading the whole lot in one go, because it's like a very, very, very long sentence in a way.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. that's good. So, Rose, is that what you then did? And
so that's what I did on Alison's suggestion. I thought, well, I'll see if I like it any better or if it sounds any more instructive. And I came across chapter 2, verse 25, that in the Amplified has a part of it in italics. And verse 25 says, "For who can eat or who can have enjoyment any more than I can," and in italics, "apart from him." And I thought, oh, I've never seen those three words before. Mm. That gives meaning to the whole book, that really you can't do any of these things and let it have meaning apart from being near God. So then I checked in my NASB, and verse 25 just says without him. So that still was the same thing. Then I checked in John's New King James.
Yeah.
And those words aren't there. So I checked in the King James and those words aren't there. But they are in the NASB, and they are in my NIV, and they are
right. And are they there in the Hebrew?
I'll tell you, the old interlinear.
Yeah. that comes the magnifying glass again. Yeah.
Well, it gives meaning to the whole book. To say that without him, it is all meaningless.
Okay, and that's interesting, because this Amplified version, it might be adding words that are helpful. It might be trying to interpret it in a certain way. It might be adding words that are not there. So you've got to be careful. But I think anything that helps us with a difficult book like this, so maybe because we're going to look at it in much more detail next time, and therefore you all want to read it in the coming few days, maybe that's one option. Get yourself an amplified version of it, or maybe some other more paraphrased version, shall we say, or modern version. But off the top of your head, can anyone quote anything from the book that you know for sure is definitely in the book of Ecclesiastes? You don't know where it is or what it means. Anything that's familiar?
There's nothing new under the sun.
Okay, that occurs a lot.
There's a day to be born and a day to die, etc., and it has a whole list of things.
All the times for this, the times for that, and so on. It's a very common bit. Yeah. Any idea what "there's nothing new under the sun" actually means? I mean, is it obvious, or is there an extra meaning?
It's obvious.
What line does he...
I think Solomon makes it sound like he's tried everything, and you know, it seems like more the same old for him to try anything new.
And why do you think he uses the phrase "under the sun"?
Well, it would have to mean for people who were still alive.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's a poetic way of putting something. So therefore, we know the phrase. It's a common one. We can quote it. There's another one that he uses a lot, which again, you might be familiar if it's pointed out to you, where he keeps saying, all the days of my life, all the days of my life, all the days of my life. Now, that's a little easier to grasp in the sense of what he's saying, as long as I'm alive, because for him, there's nothing afterwards. So he can't see time-wise beyond this life. Under the sun is actually, sorry, am I getting feedback or is it someone else talking there? I'll try again. Under the sun is basically saying wherever the sun shines its light, which basically means this world, this life. He can't see beyond this life and this world. He's trapped in time and space in terms of just purely what he can see around him and the life that he's got and that it will end. Mm. This is a perspective based upon no belief in eternal life or in anything outside of his current experience and existence. And from that point of view, I imagine that's... someone's got a problem. I think that's where we got that from. Okay. He's telling us there that he has got a very restricted view. And therefore, all his thinking, all his philosophy, if you want to call it that, is constrained by those two things. When you bear that in mind, you'll realise that his conclusions are probably true and accurate. So the question then is, how do you develop something that goes beyond this life, beyond this world, and so on? Now, someone has already mentioned the magic word of Solomon. We'll leave most of this to next time, but why do we think that this is written by Solomon? Why do you not think it's written by Solomon? Or have you ever thought that it is or isn't written by Solomon?
Yeah, it starts out the words of the preacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem.
Right. And you therefore think that means the next immediate son, king of Jerusalem. And yet, so why does he call himself the teacher then? What's this word teacher all about? Look at verse 12. Look at verse 12.
King.
More precisely, what does he say?
King.
What does he say about himself? Does he say
he's king over Israel? So he's in and in Jerusalem.
You've missed the key word.
Was. Oh, I'm teacher was.
Was.
No. Was.
Was king over.
I, Israel. The king, was king.
Oh.
Who could ever say that?
David.
Well, but nobody was alive that could then say, I once was king, but I'm not now. You understand? You were king,
yes.
You died as king. Okay. David. So that's one thing that strikes a little spanner in that particular set of works, if you like. And there are other little places like that which throw up the fact that this really isn't Solomon. It's someone, and the Hebrew itself actually is much later than Solomon would have used. That's something else that scholars like to come up with.
Mm.
When we talked before about the book, The Wisdom of Solomon, do you remember I said that it claims to be like Solomon, but no one is saying it is by Solomon. In fact, it was so much later, it was in Greek and so on. This is another book which has got a sort of Solomon flavor to it because he was known as the wisest man and so on. But this guy is primarily, in his opening statement, the teacher. And then he claims to be, or is, it's a sort of device, literary device, saying, imagine I am the son of David, king of Jerusalem, or imagine I have been that, or I'm going to imagine I'm that. I'm going to take you on a journey as though I was Solomon, and I'm going to show you what life was like and all the things that Solomon had, and I'm going to show you the conclusion you come to. If. He's actually playing at let's be king for a day. I don't know if you've ever played that game, you know. What would it be like if I was king for a day or a week, something like that? I don't want to be king. I don't want to be like that all the time. But just imagine all the privileges I would have, all the benefits. Surely I'd have the most wonderful life of all. And he's saying, let's have a think about this. He is primarily a teacher. There is a Hebrew word that you you might have got in a footnote to explain that word, why it's translated as teacher. Does anyone know what I'm talking about there, this Hebrew word?
The Kohelet.
The Kohelet, okay? Spelled with a Q, Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H, the Kohelet. Now, think the Kohelet. You remember the word Kahal?
Kahal. Yeah, it's a congregation, isn't it? It's a group, the whole.
It's the word that is really what we meant to have instead of church. It's the assembly, it's the gathering, it's the congregation. So the Kohelet is the person who gathers together an assembly, a group, a congregation, for the purposes of instructing them. Okay? So it's like he's the classmaker, or a better word. The school guy, or whatever you want to call him. He is primarily not a king. He is a teacher. He is a wise man. Now, of course, you could say Solomon, with all his proverbs, had that role. He gathered all these proverbs in order to teach, in order to spread wisdom and so on. Okay, but this doesn't read in the same sort of way as the proverbs. As we said, it's almost a let's think bigger and differently now about this. Solomon gives us lots of nice, neat little things. Let's blow them all apart and pretend otherwise. So if you are going to read it in the week to come, and when we pick it up next time, I want you to move away from the traditional this is definitely Solomon, but enter into his, should we call it his game? I don't want to quite call it a game, but his mental exercise for you, and just go along with him and say, I've got all this wealth, I've got all these opportunities, I've got all this power. Life must be absolutely wonderful. Oh, but it isn't, or it wasn't. And actually, he drops this pretense of being the king of in Jerusalem pretty early on. So that's why you will never actually find the name Solomon in here. And after a while, you just sort of forget that he started like that. And when you get to the end, which is a way in which you would then start to, well, he's describing, someone else is perhaps describing here, but the very end in chapter 12 is, not only was the teacher wise, but also imparted knowledge to the people. And then you get that he set out proverbs and so on, and talks about his role as that. So who is he? I'm going to leave it sort of unknown as such. I would imagine, though, that he's someone who is thinking back, sort of putting on the garb, if you like, of Solomon in his position, and saying, let's think through life now in a different sort of way, see what conclusions we come up with. So this guy, I'll call him Q for short, Kohelet. I'll call him Q, the author, had a more ambitious goal than just writing proverbs. He was prepared to use skepticism to question a lot more, and let's see what he came up with. So he describes himself in part, but he is mainly interested simply in helping us to think life through differently. I once had to answer the question, is Kohelet a pessimist, a realist, or just plain confused? And I'll leave that question with you, and you can make your choice, or maybe come up with something different. Is he a pessimist, a realist, or is he just completely muddled up? So we'll look at that book next time, and I'll leave it there for now, okay? I'm going to stop the recording there. Anyone got any final comment on anything that we said? Anyone want to add anything at this point?
No, thank you very much. I'm sorry, I need to leave now, but thanks a lot.
We're stopping. Yeah. I'm just making sure. Yeah. I'll stop the recording now then.
Okay.
That's the